Hvorfor skal man bruke mester?
Du har jo utdannet, du har jo giddet å ta deg brye med å gå skoletida.
Både det faglige, økonomi, drift, ledelse, alt som hører med, som du lærer om på mesterutdannelsen. Jeg sier jo med stolthet at jeg er byggmester.
Finn din mester blant 70 håndverksfag på mesterbrev.no. Da er du i trygge hender.
Welcome to Ukraina-podden, a podcast from Nettavisen. My name is Tormod Malvinsæter, and today I have my partner in pod, if you can call it that, Jørn Sund Henriksen, with me, and also our guest today, Simon Schuster, journalist and author. Welcome to us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
It's amazing to have you here, and you're like on this Europe tour right now, your last day in Norway, promoting your new book about Zelensky and the first year of the invasion. And if you were going to sell it in to anyone, what's the book about? Like, what do we get there that we don't get anywhere else?
I'd say it's a wartime biography of President Zelensky that really tries to describe how he experienced the invasion and how he responded to it and why he has been a fairly effective leader, even though he doesn't have a lot of wartime experience in his past. I think what the book does that's new is it takes you inside the presidential compound in those early days of the invasion. And it also takes you back to the early years of his life and his career, where he came from, and how he developed certain personality traits and qualities that have been quite useful to him, perhaps surprisingly useful, in the war.
Yeah, because I think it was really fascinating reading about your description of Kryvyi Rih. Your Ukrainian and Russian is much better than mine, but how that was a quite rough place to grow up, and that kind of shaped Zelensky, didn't it? Or
it did. Yeah, it was a very rough working class place. It had serious crime problems with street gangs in the 1980s and 90s when Zelensky was growing up there. He managed to avoid the criminal underbelly of Kryvyi Rih, largely thanks to his family. His grandfather was a senior police official in the city, but also because he very early in his life became interested in comedy, in performing comedy. This particular kind of comedy that emerged in the Soviet Union, it's comedy done not really as stand-up, but as a team of comedians performing for an audience and a group of judges. And it's a kind of comedy competition. So you have different teams performing on the same stage, and the judges decide who is the funniest at the end of the show. So I think this brought out his competitive nature, and it also made him comfortable in front of a massive audience. I think it also made him appreciate and need the affirmation and support of an audience to make people laugh, to make people love him, to make people enjoy themselves as he stood on the stage. And this is something that he really pursued for his entire career before he went into politics.
Yeah, and that's quite a big contrast, like being a comedian, being addicted to the applause and making people laugh. That's not what you get when you're a president. How was that change for him, you think?
Yeah, I tried to explain this to him when we first met. We met when he was running for president. This was March 2019. He was a few months into his campaign, and I met him backstage of one of his comedy shows in Kyiv. And I got to hang out with him and his group of friends that performs with him, these other comedians, actors, dancers, singers. And it's a very fun group of people. And after the show, I went backstage to his dressing room to talk, to have our first interview. And I told him, you know, if you win the presidency, your life will become a lot less fun. Are you sure you want to do this? It seems like you're having a very good time here with all your friends surrounding you. You're a movie star. You're adored by your fans. If you become president, you will not be as widely adored. You know, the media, the journalists will question you. A lot of the Ukrainian people will turn against you, because that's just how politics works. And yeah, he sort of thought about it and said, well, we'll see. We'll give it a try. Maybe it won't be as bad as you think, Simon.
Yeah, and I guess if there's one country that really has like a tradition for turning against their politicians, it's Ukraine. Like, yeah. Jörn, he knows a lot more about Ukraine than me, but who was the president that got elected and then in the re-election he got 5%?
Yeah, Yushchenko. I was there during the Orange Revolution as an election observer, and we were very hopeful that, yeah, Ukraine has turned the page and stuff, but that quickly went sour, and he got 5.5 something in his re-election campaign. Yeah. And Yanukovych came back, and well, I thought that was that. That was putting Ukraine on the path of Belarus. But here we are.
Yeah, I'd say Ukraine has a long tradition of skepticism and dismissiveness toward authority, generally. Mm. In some sense, that is one difference between the national identity of Ukrainians and Russians. Russians generally have a much more kind of obedient attitude toward their leaders, whereas Ukrainians just always enjoy making fun of or ridiculing and cutting down people who try to lead them. It's always a very unruly and a difficult country to lead.
But their experience sort of warrants that, because they're they have the history of the Soviet Union, but also since independence, most of their presidents has not been really like liberal Democrats. But how important do you think it is that Zelensky, given the situation he ended up in being a wartime president, how important do you think it is that he came to power in such an unorthodox way that he's not part of the political establishment? Because I would imagine that, well, you've interviewed a lot both Yanukovych and Poroshenko, and I imagine that to become top of the political elite in Ukraine the normal way, you're probably not unfamiliar with corruption on some level. How important do you think it is that Zelensky came into power in this unorthodox way from the sidelines, so to speak?
That was really central to his political campaign. He presented himself as an outsider to politics. He was very much an outsider to politics. He had spent his career making fun of politicians. So I think at that time in particular, Ukrainians were very frustrated with the political clans that had ruled the country since its independence in 1991. Ukrainians, many of them, had the feeling that these political clans, these oligarchs, would basically change positions in power, but very little would change in the country. They would take turns ruling. They would steal a lot of the country's resources, and then the next clan would come to power and so on. This was kind of a typical viewpoint, and it's one that Zelensky really shared. And what he proposed, what he believed he could do, is come in as an outsider and kick out these old political clans and try to breathe new life, fresh air into the political system, and really kind of destroy or certainly renew that system. That is what he promised and what he tried to do. Fairly effectively, I think. He definitely was an outsider.
Yeah, and that sounds very familiar to to the US, like Drain the Swamp and Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I guess it's almost exactly the same, isn't it?
In that sense, I think so. I think that is a fair comparison between Zelensky and Trump. They both had this idea of coming in as outsiders, anti-establishment politicians, in some ways populists, and promising to kick out the political elites. This was a trend really throughout that period, you know, certainly starting in 2016 with Donald Trump's election, but also in many countries around the world, in Europe.
Brexit.
Brexit comes to mind, you know, Beppe Grillo in Italy. There were a lot of these kind of, you know, anti-establishment populists coming to power at the time. And I do think Zelensky fits into that general mold. But beyond that, there really is not a lot of similarity with characters like Trump. I guess other than the fact that both of them come from the entertainment world, so Trump was a reality TV celebrity before he went into politics, but as people and as leaders, they're very different.
Yeah, like that's, there should be no further comparison between them. But I guess you're onto something there, that they have like kind of the same background. They know the kind of the name of the game with the media and how to make an impression.
Yeah. They're masters of social media and keeping the attention of their audience, of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. And how important has that been for Ukraine after full-scale invasion? Because I think we've all seen Zelensky in countless speeches, videos everywhere, and he's constantly able to make an impression on anyone.
Yeah, I think that has been critical to Ukraine's success in this war and to his success as a wartime diplomat. So one thing that he was able to do very effectively that I don't think another leader of Ukraine would have managed is speaking not only to other presidents, prime ministers, and asking them for help and support in the war, but also addressing the public, the people who elected those leaders in foreign democracies, and keeping all of us engaged in the war, making all of us believe and feel that this war is defending values that we all share with Ukraine. And this was a message he delivered in fairly innovative ways, in interesting ways, through his social media videos that he put out multiple times a day, through his speeches to different, very different venues and platforms, like the Grammy Awards. You know, he would meet and invite different opinion makers from foreign countries, like movie stars or musicians. He would try to engage them and win their support to try to create this kind of from the bottom up pressure on the political leadership to keep the focus on Ukraine and keep the support going. And that really relied on his abilities as a showman, an entertainer, someone who really understands how the media works and how to rouse emotion and win hearts and minds.
And we saw that here in Norway. I have friends who are very left wing in politics, and in like the early days of the war, I would meet them, and they would say, "I just wake up every morning checking if he's still alive." And in normal circumstances, these people would like demonstrate in front of an ammunition plant, but they're like, "We need to get him more weapons," and that's, of course, the situation that Ukraine were in, but his role and his videos and his, "I don't need a ride, I need ammunition," that had a tremendous effect, I think.
Is that quote true, you know? Like, you were there in the first couple of days. Is that exact quote true, that "I don't need a ride, I need ammunition"?
He said it in the video, didn't he?
No, he didn't say it in a video. It appeared in an article by the Associated Press. And I did not use it in the book. It appeared as a kind of an anonymous quote summarizing something that Zelensky said. Officials in the White House have disputed that quote, which is why I decided not to use it. The American side, which was supposedly listening to him say that on the phone, their position has basically been, it's a great line, but we never heard that on the phone. So it's open to question. I think what happened with that quote is it was a very colorful summary of the message that he was sending overall.
Yeah.
So that might have been a message, but not the exact words. Maybe.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who is Zelensky when the cameras are not there? Like, who is he as a person and as a leader without the cameras? Can you describe that?
Yeah, I think there's a few things that make him feel different to me compared to many of the politicians that I've met and talked to. He really listens when you're talking to him. He often starts an interview or a conversation by asking for your opinion of what's going on. What do you think we should do? What do you think of this decision that we just made? Is it right? Is it wrong? So he really asks you for your views.
That's also, you're right about that. Like, in the first couple of days, he could ask like anyone that was nearby him, like it could be a secretary, and then he could ask them about what they should do next, the military almost.
Yeah, he still does that. He still does that with basically anyone he meets, people who he has around him. It's his way of sort of checking whether his intuition is on the right track. And that comes through. It creates a very kind of natural human feeling to the conversations. It doesn't seem like he's pompous or putting on some kind of show. He really engages with the person he's talking to, and just seems like a very natural, open, and normal guy. And very empathetic. I think that also comes through. You know, the way that he talks about the victims of the war and the horrors that the Russians have committed in Ukraine, he really thinks of it and talks about it as individuals, the individual victims. He doesn't talk about it in these kind of grand world historical terms of the long-suffering masses sacrificing for the good of the country. He talks about it in terms of, you know, the father who has lost a son, the wife who has lost a husband. And he gives you often very kind of specific anecdotes or stories of suffering to that show, to me at least, that he experiences it through on an individual level, on a personal level, and not on some abstract level.
Yeah. And do you see any difference between the 2024 version of Zelensky and the 2019 version you first met? Because I guess like 2 years of full-scale war, I must do something with a man? Or is he like more or less the same guy?
No, he's changed very dramatically in the last 2 years. He's become much tougher. There's much less time for jokes and small talk and kind of easygoing banter. It's very much all business all the time. There's a kind of heaviness and a darkness to him now that didn't exist before. And when I ask him about, you know, his transformation, he says, yeah, obviously, you know, if you see every day the kind of horrors that I'm seeing, you know, with the loss of life, the torture, the destruction of cities, that changes you. And he says, in one of our interviews, he said it feels like, you know, he's aged 10 years in 2 years. Once he described, you know, sitting around with his one of his aides and saying, by the end of this war, how many years do you think we will have aged? And they were saying, yeah, maybe 20. Wow. So you can see it in his face also. You can see the transformation. In the book, I include two kind of before and after photos. One photo is a portrait taken 2 months before he became president, and one is 2 months after the full-scale invasion. There's a difference of 3 years there, but it looks like he's transformed. You know, he's become a much older man.
Yeah, and you could also see that when he was in Oslo in December, you could also see that he's an older man now than 2 years ago. Like, that was the first time I saw him in person. But you can see that, like, that's a man that's been under an enormous pressure the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So, but do you think the change he has been going through is like, is it good or bad? That might be a very easy question. But, like, has he become a worse leader, or is it just a necessary change? Because I guess you can't be the same leader during a full-scale war than in a peacetime.
I think it's unavoidable, yeah. You know, a war on this scale and with so many horrors would do this to anyone, would transform anyone. Generally, I think he's become more effective and efficient as a leader, and just in my opinion. He makes decisions, you know, more quickly and more decisively. He is much more confident in his, for example, answers to questions when you're talking to him. He knows what he wants to say. I think the person I met in 2019 and also in the first year or even year and a half of his presidency when I would meet him, he was still kind of learning politics, and he would hesitate. He would search the room for his advisors before answering a difficult question to make sure he was maybe on the right track. And now there is no hesitation. It's very direct, and he knows that he is in the right position, that he, this is his role now. There's no questioning or hesitation in his leadership decisions and his behavior as a leader.
Yeah, and we recently seen Zelensky do some kind of hard decisions when he sacked General Zelensky. And that's also something you write about in the book, like the difficult relationship between Zelensky and Zelensky, because that did not start recently. That's been going on for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the book really focuses a lot on that relationship because it tells you a lot about how Zelensky has transformed. early in the invasion, he really let the generals do the fighting, and he didn't interfere in their decisions. You know, he would ask them, what support do you need? How can I help you? But he left the strategic military decisions to them. Over time, what you see over the course of the story of the first year of the invasion is he develops much more confidence in his own decisions as a military leader, as a military strategist. And in some ways, on very specific decisions, he disagrees with the generals about where to attack, how to attack, how to use military resources. So that led to disagreements, including with General Zaluzhny, who was recently dismissed as the top military commander. Honestly, I'm a bit surprised that it took so long. I think Zelensky was sensitive to public opinion because the general was and remains extremely popular. He has enormous support among the military rank and file, regular soldiers, but also just among regular people. The general is seen as the savior of the country. So I think Zelensky was quite sensitive to that and waited quite a long time before dismissing him. But ultimately, it became too distracting and difficult to have the two most powerful men in the country clashing and disagreeing behind the scenes for so long. I think under the Constitution, Zelensky is the supreme commander in chief, and he needs to have the military leaders that he is comfortable with. So that is the move he decided to make. And now in the high command, he is undisputedly the boss.
Yeah. And one of the disagreements between Zaluzhny and Zelensky was the Kharkiv counteroffensive. Yeah. Because if I remember correctly from the book, Zaluzhny did not want to go on the offensive in Kharkiv, but Zelensky wanted them to do and decided that they should go on the offensive, and he put General Syrsky in command for that. But what was like kind of the arguments back and forth there? Because Zaluzhny wanted the army to go in Kherson, or how was that?
Yeah, General Zaluzhny was more focused on this methodical, slow, and very ambitious push to the south. That is strategically more important, you could say, than Kharkiv, because it could really break the back of the Russian occupation by cutting the land bridge between Russia and Crimea. That was ultimately the goal, to push south all the way to Crimea and cut the Russians off east of the Crimean Peninsula. Hopefully retaking even Mariupol. That was sort of a later goal. That was the direction that the general was focused on, and he was sort of slowly preparing for that, massing resources, training troops with the help of Ukraine's Western allies. But it was taking a long time, and it was a slow fight. And Zelensky could see, everyone could see from the satellite images, that the Russians were weaker in the totally different part of the front. They were weaker around Kharkiv. They had moved a lot of their forces away from Kharkiv to the south to defend against General Zaluzhny's counteroffensive. And the Russian lines around Kharkiv were very thin. So Zelensky made the point that, look, in order to maintain the support of the West, we need to demonstrate that we can win.
Because that was kind of a big question, if Ukraine was able to go on the offensive, because they have been like proven themselves good on a defensive war. But I think there was a lot of questioning from Western analysts if they were able to actually go on offensive and win back land.
Yeah, I mean, they had won the Battle of Kyiv. You know, they pushed the Russians out of the Kyiv region. That was a big victory. But at that point, we're talking about late summer, early fall of 2022, Zelensky felt that his diplomatic efforts to get more heavy weaponry from the West was slowing down. And in order to break through to convince Western allies that, look, your weapons are making a difference in this war, they're not just disappearing into some kind of war of attrition, we are getting back territory, he insisted that they needed to demonstrate a victory. So he ordered this offensive in the northeast, which was extremely successful. Mm. In the matter of a week or 10 days, they got back, you know, thousands of square kilometers, hundreds of towns and villages. You know, the Russians were humiliated, and it really showed the world that Ukraine can win. And it did have an effect, a noticeable effect, on the amount of weapons that were then that began arriving into Ukraine after Ukraine demonstrated this victory. So I think, you know, military historians and analysts will continue to debate who made the right decision there. You know, what was the right position? I don't know. The book just presents the kind of the discussion and the debate, but it's an interesting disagreement. I mean, the kind of the need to demonstrate victory versus this kind of slow, methodical approach. That was basically the two sides there.
But that's also a very typical sort of tension between politicians and generals in wartime, because Solushny looked at this on a purely strategic military way, but Zelensky has other problems as well. He has political problems that he needs military solutions to.
Yeah.
And this proof of concept that they actually could take land, and that's probably something that Solushny didn't factor in, because that's not his job. Mm-hmm. So Churchill had the same problem in World War II. So I think that's typical. Do you think are the sort of relationship between Zelensky and the new general, is it better so that it could be less vulnerable to this kind of tension? Or do you think that this will potentially build up again?
No, definitely they are much closer. I think General Sirsky in Kyiv is known to have a very close relationship with the president's team, and is seen as really a member of that team, not some kind of independent power base, but really a fitting into the hierarchy of the state under Zelensky. So I would not expect Sirsky to, you know, have the kinds of disagreements with the president that Zelensky did.
Yeah, but You've been more in Ukraine than most of us, and you followed Zelensky so close. But is there like any imprecise perceptions about the war in Ukraine you see in Western media? Like, is there, how does the Western media cover Ukraine and Russia's war on Ukraine?
I think one idea that I often hear in Western media and among Western analysts and politicians, honestly, is this idea that, you know, eventually we will need to pressure Zelensky to negotiate. That if he's not willing to sit down at the table with Putin, we will need to take certain steps to basically force him. I think one thing that's poorly understood is the amount of agency and the amount of stubbornness that Zelensky has, and the mechanisms he's developing to essentially prevent himself from being put in a corner that way. That's something that he has been working on for a long time now, more than 6 months. One very important dimension of that is domestic production of weapons. So that has been a real priority for him and his team starting, I'd say, in the first half of 2023, where they're really trying to revive and develop the factories inside Ukraine, workshops. They have a lot of success with drones, to some extent with missiles, also artillery shells. So that is all to prepare for the possibility that someone like Donald Trump comes back to the White House, takes power, and tries to turn off the support, to basically stop the support.
Yeah, because when we were in Ukraine last week, we had an interview with Mr. Alexander Kamshinek.
Commission,
yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. We had a sit down with him. It was a very, very nice talk.
Yeah.
And I guess he's very central.
That's
in,
right.
In this, building up the Ukrainian arm industry.
Yeah, he's at the center of that. And I think it's, he's quite a late arrival in Zelensky's inner circle, but now I think he's really very close to the president. Some refer to him as Zelensky's new favorite, just because, well, first of all, he's very effective and quite a good leader and has leadership qualities that are rare, but also because his mission is so important, the developing weapons, homegrown weapons, because I think that will decide in many ways the next months and potentially year or so of the conflict. So Western support is declining. If it continues to decline, can Ukraine develop enough of its own military industry to make up for that? Commission says, honestly, we will never be self-reliant. That's just not realistic. We always will need Western support, financial support, military technology. But he is working as fast and as hard as he can to try to make up for that decline from Western support.
Yeah, and something he told us, which I think was very interesting, is that now they have the capacity to produce more weapon, but they lack the funding. So like they have like the everything they need except from the money. And it still means that they can't produce as much as they could, but it means that they're like on the way to something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're counting on the European funds to help a lot with that. Honestly, when I talk to the Ukrainian side, they are optimistic that the Americans will also come through. Maybe that's naive. I don't know. I'm not really an expert in American politics at all, but they seem to believe that helping Ukraine for the Americans is such an obvious national security interest that the Americans will eventually resolve their internal political fights and come through. Yeah, I don't know.
Even though you're not an expert on American politics, you're the only American in this room. So what's your take on the situation there? Like, they're still debating it doesn't seem like it's going to pass it's not going to even be voted on in Congress for the next, like, foreseeable future.
There's a lot of pressure on the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, to put this to a vote. Now, if you look back even a few months, this is a much better situation for Ukraine than it was. So now everyone acknowledges that if the Congress votes, Ukraine will get the support. So now Johnson is in this very uncomfortable position where he basically is blocking the vote, right? Blocking the will of the Congress. And I don't know how long politically he can sustain that. He is clearly afraid of Trump's supporters inside the Congress, and he's trying to not make them angry, because if they want, they can remove him from the speakership. But it's a tough position, and I think over time there is room for optimism that essentially he will have to put it to a vote, and the numbers are very clearly in Ukraine's favor there.
Yeah, and I think also we should talk a little bit about Russia while we have you here. You were born in Russia, right?
Yeah, I was born in Moscow. Yeah.
Moscow, yeah. Born in Soviet Union is maybe more more precise back then. And you also knew Alexei Navalny pretty well. You interviewed him a lot of times. And now last week we got the sad news about his death.
Yeah.
And how will the world remember Navalny, you think?
Yeah, that was really tough piece of news for me. I mean, his legacy is pretty clear. He's the one who showed Russians not to be afraid. He showed them the means and the mechanisms of taking action as citizens to influence their government. He was really an activist against passiveness, this idea that's very common in Russia that, well, the leadership in the Kremlin is like the weather. We can't control it. There's nothing we can do to influence them. And he really showed a whole generation of Russians that is not true, that the people do have the power, even if there are no democratic instruments like elections and so on in Russia under Putin. There are still ways that we can pressure and influence and change the political system. That is a kind of awakening that will continue to reverberate and resound through the years in Russia, because once the generation of his peers learned that, I think you can't unlearn it. I think they have realized that there are ways that you can influence the state. That's an optimistic point of view. Right now, things look very dark, especially with Alexei gone. It's not clear who can step up and really play the same role as a unifying figure, a kind of nucleus of hope. When we would imagine Russia after Putin, he represented a kind of the face of a possible future Russia, someone who had the charisma, the political skills, and the support base to potentially step into a leadership vacuum that might emerge after Putin. Now, that kind of opposition force has no face. It has no individual to lead it. Maybe someone will emerge, but that is an enormous loss to the opposition movement.
Yeah, and I think also it's almost impossible to find another Navalny like now, because he had this unique charisma and able, like he was very good, as Zelensky was a very good communicator. Yeah. And he also had, he talked English, which helps, doesn't help inside Russia, but I guess it helps a lot outside, like to get mm-hmm. the attention and get the sympathy from the rest of the West or yeah. rest of the world.
Yeah, I think so.
But you, sorry, John.
Yeah, and also the courage. He must have known, like all of us said, that after they tried to kill him, he still went back to Russia. He must have known that there was a very high likelihood that he wouldn't survive that.
Yeah, I think that's another point of comparison we can make to Zelensky there, that both of them clearly put their lives on the line.
Yeah,
in defense of their cause.
Yeah. But do you think his death will have any consequences for Putin and his regime at all?
It's hard to say. I mean, history does show that autocratic totalitarian regimes, they can last generations, but they can also collapse very quickly, all of a sudden, for reasons that are very unpredictable. And you know, when the people and the system doesn't have a kind of a way for the elites or the population to express frustration or kind of enact change in the system, when it's so rigid, it also is quite fragile. Yeah. So I don't know. I think after 17 years of reporting on Russia and Ukraine, the one thing you learn is don't make bold predictions about the future, because history surprises you again and again.
None of us predicted Prigozhin's run towards Moscow, and none of us predicted that it would stop so suddenly as well. So, so they're, I guess the kind of power that they have is hard but brittle.
Yeah,
so exactly. It could suddenly break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we saw that I think Josep Borrell in like the what do you call it? He's one of the leaders in the European Union.
The foreign policy chief. Yeah,
exactly.
Of the EU.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. He like suggested that maybe you should rename the Magnitsky Act to the Navalny Act. I'm not sure how serious that was, but if that's the response from the West, I would not say that's a very strong answer.
No, that is very symbolic, to put it mildly. I don't know. It's a tough position for the West and Western policymakers, because they have used up a lot of their ammunition in terms of sanctions and political pressure. But one thing that has just been a mystery to me is this $300 billion in frozen Russian state assets, foreign currency and gold reserves that are in the West, belong to Russia. You know, if the West says that we can't afford to help Ukraine anymore, okay, hey, there's this huge pot of Russian money, give it to Ukraine. I mean, that is a clear move. And I hear all the arguments about setting a precedent, you know, hurting the value of the United States and the dollar as a reserve currency. There are all these kind of macroeconomic and geopolitical arguments against doing that. I don't find any of them very convincing, honestly. I think that is one instrument that is just right there on the table. Just use it.
Yeah, you have the money, and you have the, you know, on which account the money are, so you just need to send them to Ukraine, right?
But I guess a situation like that and many others, I understand that Zelensky, whomever he meets, however frustrated it is that he doesn't get more help, he has to be thankful and generous and things like that. Do you have any experience with him? Do you know how frustrated he really is, like behind closed doors, with support of the West in general or some countries in particular, like Norway?
I don't know specifically about Norway. I haven't followed that relationship in detail. But yeah, the last time I talked to him, this was in October 2023. We traveled together from Kyiv to Odessa on his train, and we talked during that trip. And he described feeling very frustrated and exhausted by the need to constantly remind Western leaders that no, Ukraine is still in the fight. We need your support. We have a chance of winning. We are winning. And it's getting harder and harder. You know, he sees that the world's attention span has its limits. As he put it, fatigue or frustration with the war is rolling along like a wave across the United States and Europe, and he feels like it's his job to constantly try to hold it back. Yeah. But he's working against the clock because eventually, you know, people get tired. So that's his main mission. It's I guess a diplomatic mission to try to constantly remind the world that Ukraine is winning. Ukraine has a chance. There is a way to victory.
But the lack of success of the counteroffensive, did that also contribute to the frustration with General Zelensky? Did he want him to take more risks or be more aggressive during that counteroffensive, or were they sort of aligned through that period?
They were aligned about the military strategy and the importance of that vector, that direction. Yeah, there were disagreements, but not really about, you know, the need to push to the south. The disagreements were actually in the messaging. When I think the main moment when we saw the conflict between them move from backstage to the public sphere was when Zelensky decided to declare publicly that there is a stalemate on the front line and that there will be no breakthrough in the south in the counteroffensive. Zelensky was not ready for that kind of message. He hadn't been preparing the Ukrainian population for that kind of signal, and no less important, Western allies. So the president's office began getting phone calls from Western capitals saying, there's a stalemate? What's this? Is this your position? Right? So that put him in a very awkward spot. That doesn't change the reality or the necessity of military decisions, but it's a messaging problem that I think you know, the president was perhaps rightly frustrated with that, you know, you should have a unified message. But yeah, that I think was one of the breaking points in the relationship.
Do you think we're going to see any changes like on the military tactics from Ukraine now when Sirski is the guy in charge?
I think so. They're being pretty open about this. So the phrase that you often hear the Ukrainians use now is active defense. What that refers to is what I think of as over-the-top attacks. So you have a pretty frozen or stagnant front line, but the Ukrainians are able to use their own drone technology and missiles, HIMARS, and, you know, other including homemade Ukrainian-made missile systems, to attack far behind enemy lines, inside Russian territory, hitting targets in Crimea, very importantly, hitting targets in the Black Sea. So this becomes a kind of a very dynamic and unpredictable theater of war. It expands the theater of the war well into Russian territory, which is a strategic decision that Zelensky has made and is going to pursue in the future. So that's the way that I think on the ground we're going to see the war continue to evolve.
Yeah, and last week Jørn and I also talked to a group of Ukrainian soldiers that has been to Africa fighting against Russia there. Like, is that decisions that comes all the way to Zelensky, or like the decision to send troops to bring the war to Russia in Africa or other places?
Yeah, interesting. I remember reading some reports about that. You know, this would be something in the to come from the military intelligence services, HUR. They work on these kinds of operations. I've read about a few of them, but I'm not really familiar with the thinking behind that of kind of trying to challenge, you know, Russian mercenary groups and so on in Africa. That's quite ambitious.
That's an article I would like to read if you if you decide to write it. Like, we talked to some of the soldiers, so we know it's happening. Yeah, but it would be really interesting to hear like some more official statements about it. So then you can refer in the article, you can refer to our interview in the Nettavisen. Amazing. I think we also need to mention your piece in Time magazine. I think it was last autumn that's made some controversy in the especially among the people supporting Ukraine, where you kind of described the change Zelensky has gone through, and kind of, do you know what happened? Like, why was it so taken so badly from a lot of people?
So the article describes a darker context. I think Zelensky hadn't really changed. He had remained in my conversations with him, very committed to the war and to fighting the war, winning the war, and his message that victory is coming. The circumstances of the war, this was about a month before my reporting for that story was about a month before General Zaluzhny decided to declare a stalemate. Hmm. But of course, President Zelensky and his team, they were hearing this message from the general staff before it became publicly known through the Economist interview. They were hearing these signals from the military that, guys, we're not winning. There's a stalemate on the front line. And I happened to be spending a lot of time with the president's team as they were getting these signals, and their mood was affected by it. It was quite dark. They were telling me basically what Zaluzhny later made public. They were telling me in conversations that things are not looking good. We're not expecting a breakthrough on the front lines. So we published that story. It was before Zaluzhny made the announcement public about a stalemate, but it sort of was based on the same realities of the front line that the president's team were trying to process and deal with somehow. They couldn't figure out quite how to react, how to adjust their message to that new reality on the front lines. So the picture that the article paints is quite gloomy. It's a team of people trying to figure out where to go. They've hit a kind of dead end, and they need to adjust their strategy. They need to find a new message. They need to find a new reason to help people believe in victory. But they were looking for it, and they hadn't yet found it. So anyway, when that story was published, I think a lot of people in Ukraine read it. Maybe the people I was talking to in the president's office and the president himself weren't expecting they're expecting when they talked to me, they talked to kind of the American audience, maybe not so much the Ukrainian audience. For the Ukrainian audience, the picture that story painted was very different to what they are shown on television. Yeah. Television in Ukraine is state controlled. It's basically wartime propaganda, and it paints a very optimistic picture of the wartime realities. And my article was quite in contradiction to that. So it led to a lot of questions in Ukraine among society, like what is this?
Yeah, and some of the critics, like, when there's like negative, or call it negative, articles about Ukraine, and some critics says that it's so typical that a Russian guy writes about Ukraine and then he writes something negative. How do you answer to that? Because that's an interesting.
Yeah, it's thing. Sad. I think so many of the professional Western journalists who have been reporting about Ukraine for many years have had this experience where essentially if they start, if their reporting is not 100% kind of optimistic and painting a rosy picture of the war, they're immediately accused of being Russian agents. I'm not the first one. I'm not the last one. This is very typical. I think in a time of war, things become black and white.
Yeah.
And shades of gray are lost. So people have a tendency to think, okay, are you with us or are you against us? And the problem is that with journalists, that question doesn't really apply. We have to be objective in painting for our readers, listeners, viewers, an accurate picture of reality. And when one side or the other doesn't like that picture of reality, they say, oh, you're not with us. You're against us. You must be, working with the enemy. It's I understand it. I understand the kind of thinking behind it. But it's sad that so many of the journalists working in Ukraine today, have these kinds of attacks on social media, threats. It's unfortunate, but I think it is a natural state of affairs at a time of war.
Yeah, and I'm afraid our time has come to an end. It was a pleasure having you here. Do you have like any final thoughts or something you think should be said about Ukraine and the war there?
No, just thank you for your commitment to reporting on it and keeping the focus on the war. That's been a big mission and priority of President Zelensky, to keep people paying attention and talking about it.
Yeah, if you meet him again, you have to tell him that we're the only Norwegian podcast on the war in Ukraine, as far as we know. So for what it's worth, and we're gonna say as Americans that we're gonna do the podcast for as long as it takes.
Yeah, and we mean it when we say it. It's not like we're not gonna Change too, as long as we can.
So yeah, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Simon, for sharing your time with us, and see you again.
Thank you so much.